Medicine and Molecular Medicine Podcast, and welcome to Amsterdam in the Netherlands for the International Nuclear Cardiac and Cardiac CT meeting. It's a biannual meeting that really has covered some very interesting topics, and we're going to have some great interviews. I'm sure you're going to enjoy this as much as I am. So without further ado, let's go straight to the first interview. Okay, here we are at ICNIC again, and this time we're privileged to be speaking to Dr. Dupuy, who everyone will know from uncounted publications, must be in for over a very long period of time, in every cardiology and nuclear journal you can find, there is uncounted. So I'm not going to go through the whole history, but it's a massive experience in terms of nuclear cardiology, and one thing that Dr. Dupuy has been looking at is the thing that has become ubiquitous at this meeting and should have happened a long time ago, I think, but certainly ubiquitous. I mean, everybody says you should be using enhanced reconstruction techniques, and I don't just mean iterative reconstruction. I mean iterative reconstruction with extras, so that it improves the image quality and reduces the time or reduces the dose at which the activity that you give the patient. So I'm going to start by handing over to Dr. Dupuy and just tell us about where he is at the moment and what's happening and some of the projects that he's got on hand, and then perhaps go through talking about what choices you've got as a clinician in terms of these types of algorithms and software and software-hardware combinations.
Thanks very much. There has been a lot of development in both hardware and software. Hardware, of course, with the new cameras and the focused detectors and the new semiconductor detectors allow us to do much, much faster imaging, doing a stress scan in 2 to 3 minutes and a resting scan in 4 minutes. And this opens a lot of possibilities of either decreasing scan acquisition time or else decreasing patient radiation dose. What I've done most of my work in is instead development of new software methods or validation of new software methods that similarly allow us to have decreased patient radiation dose or decreased acquisition time simply by modifying and augmenting our software. The software takes into account three things. First is iterative reconstruction, or OSEM. And this basically gives us a higher quality image with lower counting statistics. Iterative reconstruction has been around for many years, but it's actually been relatively slow to catch on in the field. But it is very robust on all the vendor systems. The newer developments first include resolution recovery, where basically the blurring that you have with the image or the loss of resolution with depth can be corrected or compensated for by knowing the collimator characteristics, knowing the length of the hole and the width of the hole and the degree of septal penetration. And basically knowing those parameters as well as knowing the distance of the voxel in the body from the detector head, which you know from the center of rotation, you can correct for this blurring. And since you have less loss of resolution with depth, you can reconstruct images of lower count density. So that's resolution recovery. And this has been implemented essentially by all the vendors. The other advancement is what's called noise reduction. And basically what is done is in your projection images, the signal-to-noise ratio is determined. And by proprietary algorithms, the noise in the image can be detected and basically reduced, where where in contrast, the signal from the myocardium is not affected and, in fact, can even be boosted. And this noise reduction technique, therefore, gives you a higher target-to-background ratio. In other words, higher myocardial-to-background counts, and thereby gives you sharper images with better definition of the myocardium and better definition of the left ventricular cavity. So all of the vendors in some way have combined these three advancements, namely iterative reconstruction, resolution recovery, and noise reduction in improved software that allows us to get very high quality images with lower count density. The different software programs from the different vendors perform differently, and they've also been validated to differing degrees. So I can't say at this time that all of the programs will work equally well. So be sure to consult your vendor about that. But basically, with these programs now, we have the option of doing an acquisition or acquiring an acquisition in lesser time, either half time, or one of the software programs, wide beam reconstruction, actually has a method to use quarter time acquisitions, a 3-minute stress study and a 4-minute resting study, very equivalent to what we have with the new focused collimators and semiconductor detectors. So then that's one option of decreasing the acquisition time. And in a publication we've just had in the Journal of Nuclear Cardiology, we've shown that you can equally use the full activity, the full acquisition time, but decrease the administered dose. So basically, you have the option of doing a half-time acquisition or a half-dose acquisition. And with the very latest software techniques, you can do both half-dose and half-time.
Right, and that's increasingly important because of the isotope crisis that we've had with half-dose. RSAC, which is the Radiation Advisory Board in the United Kingdom, has come out recommending that this be done in all nuclear medicine practices. So it's rapidly becoming the standard way. There's other things that are going on in terms of image reconstruction as well. Some of them talk about scatter reduction as well, and even perhaps some movement correction in terms of in the reconstruction algorithm with breathing and those sorts of things. Are they likely to happen anytime soon?
Well, some of the scatter correction algorithms are already in place, and I think the vendors will ultimately all adopt those. This further helps in sharpening up the images. Oftentimes, the noise reduction algorithms themselves sharpen the signal so much that it gives you a very optimal image quality, but certainly scatter correction will be helpful, respiratory gating, on-the-fly motion correction. All of these things are additional advancements, but I think the big advancements have actually already occurred. The noise reduction and the resolution recovery and the iterative reconstruction, I think those are the big three, and just using those, I think we will be able to considerably improve our images and also offer sort of a boutique, as it were, of options for our patients and our referring physicians. You may have patients that are elderly and can't tolerate prolonged imaging, or they have arthritis, or they're claustrophobic, and you can use a reduced acquisition time algorithm for them. On the other hand, in the majority of patients, and particularly our younger patients, and particularly premenopausal women, we're under a lot of pressure to decrease our radiation dose. Well, in those patients, you can give them half the dose or less than half the dose and do a full-time acquisition, and they can generally tolerate a full-time acquisition. So you have the options of selecting a particular acquisition protocol or a particular dose depending upon your patient's needs.
I was going to get into the fact that the pitches are improved, but they're also different. And that poses a difficulty for a lot of doctors. We're used to looking at filtered back projection, so we're used to streaking from the left lobe across of the liver across into the heart. We're used to some of that gut activity coming up. We're used to having a fairly uniform pitch all the way around the myocardium. Perhaps you might like to talk a bit about how some of these different reconstruction methods make the pitches look different. Even though they're better, they look different, and that may take some adjusting to.
Absolutely. Most of my personal experiences with wide beam reconstruction, and we've actually published some cautions or some guidelines as to how to interpret these images, because indeed they do look better. Remember, they are much sharper, much more high-resolution images. So, for instance, we're used to sometimes seeing the apical cleft, or where the myocardium is actually physically very thin at the apex. For those of you who do CT coronary angiograms, you're used to seeing, you can see the very thin apical myocardium. Well, with filtered back projection, where we blur the images, we don't often see that. But when we get images that are sharper with OSEM and noise reduction and resolution recovery, now we start to see this apical defect as a common normal variant. And of course, you can recognize it as a normal variant because it's fixed at stress and rest, and it moves and thickens normally in the gated images. Similarly, The insertion site of the anterior free wall of the right ventricle is often seen more prominently with these new reconstruction techniques. Another thing is the posterior papillary muscle, which is not well defined. If you have a filtered back projection study, there's often just sort of this vague area of increased activity in the posterolateral or anterolateral wall. But when you sharpen the images, for instance, with wide beam reconstruction, that posterior papillary muscle is very discrete and shows up as a discrete hotspot in the anterolateral wall. Now, if your images get normalized to that hot area, the rest of the myocardium will be decreased in activity. So those are just some examples. And as a reader, when you start to use these new methods, you have to get used to these differences. And so it's always a good idea, rather than just suddenly one Tuesday when the new software arrives, just abandon the old software methods and start the new software methods. It would be a good idea to do a series of studies that in your own laboratory that are acquired using the old technology as well as the new technology, so you personally can get used to the differences and learn to read these studies.
I think the other issue is that, I mean, you mentioned the right ventricular insertion into the wall, the 11 o'clock defect. I mean, we also see similar defects when we have problems with our gamma camera, particularly in that location, or if it's not been calibrated for correctly. And whenever you're doing a technique that uses the exact orbit of a gamma camera in order to do its reconstruction, the exact orbit of the gamma camera needs to be calibrated correctly in order to occur. Otherwise, you're going to get problems. Would you say that there's potential for artifacts and problems with these new reconstruction algorithms if your servicing and your calibration of equipment is not up to scratch?
Sure. Just, for instance, the center of rotation artifact is going to be there no matter what software you use. There's no way of the software techniques are never going to get around sloppy technology. If you have patient motion is going to be there. Don't forget, any defect that's in the myocardium is going to be accentuated when you sharpen your image, whether that's an artifact or whether that is a true defect. Another thing is an example, breast attenuation. It would be wonderful if these new software programs got around breast attenuation artifacts, but they don't. Just as they accentuate real defects, oftentimes they're going to accentuate attenuation artifacts as well. I mean, not always, but sometimes it will. So don't think that these new software programs are going to get around other technical limitations. They're not. Just as, for instance, we saw with quantitative analysis. Quantitative analysis, of course, a very valuable adjunct to our imaging, but it not only accentuates or not only points out where you have true defects, it also points out where you have artifacts just as well.
The other thing to bear in mind, a lot of these new technologies go along with new hardware or new positioning. So if you've got a patient who's supine or prone or upright or semi-upright, that's going to affect your images too. Perhaps you might want to talk about those different positionings and how that might affect your images as well.
That's right. As now that this isn't so much related to the software, but we have lots of new types of cameras that allow us to do upright imaging, semi-upright imaging, supine imaging, prone imaging. But don't forget, in all of these positions, the patient's body habitus will shift. Just take a simple example. Let's take the left breast in a woman. When a woman lies supine and does not wear her bra, generally the breast is spread out over the anterior chest wall. Might cause an anterior artifact, or it might just a diffuse attenuation effect. On the other hand, if that woman is in the semi-sitting position, the breast will lie more pendulous. And when she is in the upright position, the breast will always be pendulous and create an artifact over the apex and the inferior wall. Also, for instance, when a woman is in the supine position, the right breast always moves laterally and is out of the field of view of the heart, or does not overlap the heart. But if you image a woman upright, the pendulous right breast will attenuate the septum. So this is just one example. You have the same thing with the diaphragm. The diaphragm will be lower with the patient sitting than it will be with the patient supine. It'll be lower with the patient in the prone position. So you've got to be aware of all these variants that occur with different positions, and for that reason, you always have to use a gender-specific and also a patient position-specific normal file. It would be very dangerous to try to use a supine normal file on a patient who's imaged upright. You would get a very different normal distribution. In fact, we just presented at this meeting an abstract reporting normal databases for supine versus upright images and also upright imaging with attenuation correction. And the normal distributions are very different, both in men and in women. So you need to keep these things in mind.
Okay, you're a physician out there, you're just about to buy a system. What are the sort of things that you've got to take into account when you go towards choosing what you're going to get in terms of hardware and software? You've got a choice between buying the software that comes with the vendor of your gamma camera. You've got add-on software these days. How do you decide?
Well, nobody has really done a comparison of the different vendors' software, and that is unlikely to happen, as it never has for any software technology that we've used in nuclear cardiology. So I would just caution you to, when you're looking at a system and deciding on software methods, see what kind of validation there's been. Has it been validated in the literature? How robust is the validation? If you run into a software that you've never heard of before and hasn't been validated, I'd be very cautious that it's it's worthwhile. In the same thing really goes with the cameras as well. It says, you know, look to see how well they've been validated. What are the patients that have been studied? You know, well, you can get, I mean, you can get a beautiful image with half the dose in a patient with a 36-inch chest circumference, no matter what you do, but you want to see what happens more typically in your patient with a 46-inch chest circumference. How robust is the software method? How robust is the hardware method? And not your perfect examples sometimes that the vendors will show you. You want to see more representative cases, and you want to see what kind of patients have been included in the trial that has been published.
I suppose the other thing goes along with that is truncation. Increasingly, particularly when you've got different new hardware configurations, there's potential for truncation if you're limiting the field of view of the heart. Could you talk about some of those sorts of issues with different cameras and systems?
You have to, of course, as you use a smaller field of view, there's more opportunity for truncation. Apical truncation will occur if you're using a body-centered orbit. Oftentimes the apex falls outside of the field of view of one or both of the detectors, and you can wind up with apical truncation. If you use a cardiocentric orbit where the heart is always in the center of the field of view, apical truncation is very unlikely to occur, but you have to make sure that you've centered the heart and you don't truncate the anterior or the inferior wall. So there are always drawbacks of new technologies, and certainly smaller field of view cameras fall into that consideration. Also, with the newer detectors, they're using focused detectors. For instance, the D-SPECT camera basically does a pre-scan where it focuses the solid-state detectors right on the heart. So you've got a focused image that eliminates all this extraneous activity that's contributing unnecessary counts. Well, that's a very good idea, but you want to make sure that you've got the entire heart, both the left ventricle and the right ventricle, in the field of view. The same thing with the General Electric Alcyon camera. It's using multiple multi-pinhole detectors that are cardio-focused. This is a great idea to increase the count detection from the myocardium and eliminate extraneous counts. But you've got to be very, very sure that your heart is centered within this focused field of view, or else you're going to wind up with some very serious truncation and distortion kind of artifacts.
Yeah, and I think I said the focusing also occurs with the IQ spec to some degree. There's a sweet spot area for that, and there's also a sweet spot in the cardio arc, isn't there, in terms of...
Yes.
Yes.
Exactly.
So all of them have that limitation if you've got a specific cardiac. So that's something you need to look in training for your technologists and everybody to make sure that that occurs. So there's lots of different things for you to consider. It's important that we shift. Everyone's decided that, but there's a lot of different things to consider when you go to shifting, we have to be careful of that. And we've also got to think about things like the size of the room and all the other factors and how much you pay.
Yes.
So
it often comes down to the dollar or the euro, as it were. Yes.
Yeah. So I think there's a lot of choice at last, and it's great to have choice, but with choice comes responsibility, I guess. So we need to be looking at that. Well, thank you very much. It's very interesting. Is there anything else you'd like to add along those lines, or anywhere else you can suggest that our listeners might get some more information? You talked about reports coming out.
Yeah. Well, I think one thing we probably haven't emphasized quite enough is the mandate, basically, from not only American Society of Nuclear Cardiology, but the Society of Nuclear Medicine, and basically from society itself, to decrease radiation doses. And this is a very serious consideration, and our whole lab accreditation, our reimbursement may depend on our ability to appropriately decrease radiation doses. So as you've seen here, we have this capability with the new software and the new hardware, but really we have to also design our protocols in such a way that the radiation dose is also decreased. So we want to try to do stress-only imaging whenever possible, and we want to not necessarily give high doses. If we do a two-day protocol, do too high doses unnecessarily. So there's many ways, including the hardware and software methods, also altering your protocols to decrease patient radiation dose. And I think that as we're moving forward in each and every patient that comes into the lab, we need to idealize our protocol to meet the patient's needs in terms of comfort and cooperability, but also what we want to do with that patient in terms of decreasing the radiation exposure.
Good. Well, thank you very much. Much appreciated. And we'll be looking forward to some of the new publications that are coming out about this, because I think there's plenty of room for information in this regard.
Right. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you for watching the podcast or listening to it. Thank you for making all my work in doing the podcast worthwhile by you watching it. If you could let your friends know about this and let your colleagues know so that they can watch it too, that would be great. And if you've got any feedback about what you'd like improved, whether you like the video content or not, please get hold of me at rob@nukecast.com, N-U-C-C-A-S-T.com. And of course, if you're doing something interesting in the world of nuclear medicine, let me know, because I'd like to interview you. If I can't do it in person, then by Skype. So please let me know at rob@nukecast.com. Till next time, cheerio.